Hi, I'm VOA's Alexis Strope with your worldwide news update. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Thursday announced another $135 million in aid for Palestinians. AP correspondent Karen Shamus reports.
Speaking while on a visit to Doha in Qatar, Blinken has pressed Israel to allow more aid into the war-ravaged Palestinian territory.
We all know that it's not enough to provide funding. It's not even enough to get the assistance to the borders of Gaza. What's so critical is that the aid gets to the people who need it.
After Israeli forces killed top Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in Gaza last week, but neither side has shown any sign of moderating its demands. I'm Karen Shamas.
A Lebanon donors conference in Paris on Thursday has raised hundreds of millions of dollars for the war-battered country. VOA's Lisa Bryant has more from the French capital.
Dans l'immédiat, c'est une aide massive qu'il faut apporter à la population libanaise.
Conference host, French President Emmanuel Macron, said families need shelter, children need nourishment and schooling, the wounded need care. Solutions must be found quickly, he said, especially to avoid further population displacements, which could create new divisions in the country. Acting Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati wanted more.
What we as Lebanese expect from the international community is the following: solidarity and ceasefire. Lebanon calls on the international community to come together and support efforts that will end the ongoing aggressions and enforce an immediate ceasefire.
The Paris meeting additionally aimed to find ways to support the Lebanese army and the UN peacekeeping mission in the country, which includes a large number of European troops. Both the army and the peacekeeping mission say they have come under attack by Israel. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
This is VOA News. South Korea's Presidential Security Service said that trash dropped around the presidential compound on Thursday came from North Korean balloons. It comes as propaganda leaflets were found scattered on the streets of South Korean capital Seoul. Reuters correspondent Diane Tao reports.
It appears to be the first instance of the North Korean government directly sending anti-South propaganda material across the border. Some of them made personal attacks on the South's President Yoon Suk-yeol and the First Lady. They accuse the Yoon government of failing its people and describe the first couple as immoral and mentally unstable. Since late May, North Korea has been sending thousands of balloons, often carrying trash, into various parts of its southern neighbor. It said the move was to retaliate for propaganda leaflets sent the other way by activists in the south criticizing the North's leadership.
Free North Korea!
Pyongyang has accused Seoul of being complicit.
Reuters correspondent Diane Tao. The owner and manager of the cargo ship that caused the Baltimore-Maryland bridge collapse have agreed to pay more than $100 million to settle a lawsuit brought by the U.S. Justice Department. The settlement comes a month after the Justice Department sued Dolly owner Grace Ocean Private Ltd. and manager Synergy Marine Group, seeking to recover more than $100 million that the government spent to clear the underwater debris and reopen the city's port. U.S. President Joe Biden is set to apologize on Friday for a 150-year Indian boarding school policy. AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
President Biden says this should have been done a long time ago.
Make a formal apology to the Indian nation for the way we treated their children for so many years.
A government investigation documented nearly 1,000 deaths and 74 grave sites associated with more than 500 schools. In his apology, the president says, as a people who love our country, we must remember and teach our full history, even when it is painful. I'm Ed Donahue.
British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said on Friday that the transatlantic slave trade was abhorrent and that while history cannot be changed, it should be talked about.
I think we should be clear from the outset that the slave trade, slave practice was abhorrent. And it's very important that we start from that place.
Starmer was speaking in an interview on the sidelines of the Commonwealth Heads of Government meeting held on Samoa and attended by leaders and officials from 56 countries with roots in Britain's empire. The idea of reparations for transatlantic slavery is longstanding, but has recently been gaining momentum worldwide, particularly in the countries of the Caribbean community and more recently, the African Union. Opponents of reparation payments say countries should not be held responsible for historical wrongs, while those in favor say the legacy of slavery has led to vast and persistent racial inequality today. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Alexis Strope, VOA News.
Blinken continues to push for a deal.
This is a moment to work to end this war, to bring, make sure all the hostages are home.
The world gathers in Paris to raise money for Lebanon.
Early on, both Germany and France earmarked around $100 million apiece for Lebanon. The funds will support humanitarian aid in the country.
And when Americans head to the polls this election day, they'll not only choose a president, but also senators and representatives.
Many voters in the state may vote for former president and Republican candidate Donald Trump, but will keep a Democrat in the Senate.
Today is Friday, October 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. At least 17 Palestinians, including children, were killed Thursday in an Israeli strike on a school where civilians were taking refuge. Israel says the attack targeted Hamas fighters. Freddie Joyner of Reuters has the story.
This is the aftermath of a deadly Israeli strike on a school in Gaza Thursday. More than a dozen people were killed, including children, according to a local hospital. It was where people displaced by the fighting were sheltering. This eyewitness says he heard the strike. He says the people coming out of the building were, quote, all cut up, arms and legs separate. The Israeli military said it had hit a Hamas command and control center embedded in a former school. There had been hopes that the killing of Hamas's leader Yahya Sinwar last week might provide an opening to end the fighting. But Israel is pushing on with intensive operations in northern Gaza. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in the Middle East this week in hopes of reviving ceasefire talks. He was in Doha Thursday and spoke at a news conference with Qatar's prime minister.
We had an opportunity today to talk about the way forward on the effort to bring the hostages home and to get a ceasefire. Partly this involves an assessment of exactly where Hamas stands in the wake of the death of Sinwar. We talked about that. We talked about options to capitalize on this moment and next steps to move the process forward. And I anticipate that our negotiators will be getting together in the coming days.
As the war moves into its second year, the death toll from the Israeli campaign in Gaza is approaching 43,000. Israel launched its campaign in retaliation for the Hamas-led attack on Israel last year, which killed some 1,200 people and saw more than 250 hostages taken to Gaza. It has said it will continue until Hamas is dismantled completely and the hostages returned.
That's Freddie Joyner of Reuters reporting for us. And also in the Middle East, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken continued to push for a Mideast ceasefire on Thursday. He stopped in Qatar, where negotiators have spent months trying to broker an end to the hostilities in Gaza and Lebanon and bring home about 100 hostages believed to be held in Gaza. Anita Powell has the story from Washington.
The top U.S. diplomat has been shuttling around the Middle East on a complex mission from President Joe Biden to restart talks on a Gaza ceasefire, to negotiate the return of nearly 100 hostages believed to be held by Hamas, and to support the Palestinian people whose lives were torn apart by war. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Thursday announced $135 million in additional U.S. aid for Palestinian civilians. He also said the administration felt Israel accomplished its strategic goals with the killing of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar last week.
And now that that's been accomplished, this is a moment to work to end this war, to bring, make sure all the hostages are home, and to build a better future for people in Gaza.
Qatar's leader said Thursday that his country's negotiators have re-engaged with Hamas, but he painted a murky picture of the future. Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdul Rahman Al Thani.
We had some meetings with them the last couple of days. I believe that until now there is no clarity what will be the way forward or the clear position.
Analysts aren't hopeful that this fire can be contained, especially after Israel killed Hezbollah's leader in Lebanon. The U.S. considers Hezbollah and Hamas as terrorist organizations. Gerald Feierstein is director of the Arabian Peninsula Affairs Program at the Middle East Institute.
I mean, to be entirely honest, it's not entirely clear why Tony Blinken has is making another trip to the region. There doesn't seem to be any particular prospect that he's going to achieve anything new or different than the last 10 times that he's been out there.
A top U.S. Muslim rights advocacy group says there are two obstacles to a deal: Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel's most powerful supporter, Biden. Edward Ahmed Mitchell is deputy director of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. He spoke to VOA via Zoom from Atlanta.
Mr. Netanyahu, for political and ideological reasons, has no interest in agreeing to a permanent ceasefire that frees all the hostages, pulls all Israeli troops out of Gaza, and ends the war once and for all. The only way to force him to do it is to withhold the weapons. So I do not expect Mr. Blinken's trip to succeed without that missing element.
These delicate diplomatic moves are happening well over the heads of the people who have to live through this on both sides of this bristling border and who have not seen a day of peace since October 7th, 2023. Anita Paul, VOA News, Washington.
A Lebanon donors conference in Paris on Thursday has raised hundreds of millions of dollars for the war-battered country, but ending the conflict between Israel and the Iran-backed Hezbollah militant group seems unlikely anytime soon. VOA's Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
The pledges rolled in at the Paris conference. Early on, both Germany and France earmarked around $100 million apiece for Lebanon. The funds will support humanitarian aid in the country, where fighting sparked by Hezbollah's rocket attacks on Israel has killed hundreds and displaced hundreds of thousands of people.
Dans l'immédiat, c'est une aide massive qu'il faut apporter à la population libanaise.
Conference host French President Emmanuel Macron said families need shelter, children need nourishment and schooling. The wounded need care. Solutions must be found quickly, he said, especially to avoid further population displacements, which could create new divisions in the country. Acting Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mikati wanted more.
What we as Lebanese expect from the international community is the following: solidarity and ceasefire. Lebanon calls on the international community to come together and support efforts that will end the ongoing aggressions and enforce an immediate ceasefire.
But experts doubt there will be a swift ending to the conflict. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken did not attend the Paris conference. He was in the Middle East, although Washington sent a lower-level delegation. Israel and Iran were not invited. French Defense Minister Sébastien Lecornu earlier warned that Lebanon could descend into civil war.
Je crois que le Liban risque une situation de chaos.
But analyst Antoine Vaspous told Europe One Radio that the more likely scenario was Lebanon descending into chaos. Former colonial power France hopes parties in Lebanon will move on electing a new president after a two-year power gap. The Paris meeting additionally aimed to find ways to support the Lebanese army and the UN peacekeeping mission in the country, which includes a large number of European troops. Both the army and the peacekeeping mission say they have come under attack by Israel. Lisa Bryant, VOA News, Paris.
And here's more of the stories we're following from around the world. More than 10,000 people in Haiti have been internally displaced in the past week as armed gangs operating in and around Port-au-Prince ramp up their attacks on areas they do not yet control. This according to UN Migration Agency estimates on Thursday. Moldova's pro-European president said on Thursday that mass bribery had affected a presidential election and referendum on joining the European Union, but she vowed to press on with a November 3rd runoff vote to win a second term instead of ordering a new election. Police in Moldova say a pro-Russian fugitive businessman had channeled $39 million to voters in September and October. Canada's immigration cuts, meant to ease strained housing and social services, could hurt the country's labor pool, some industry groups said. While Canada has long prided itself as a place that welcomes new immigrants, public opinion in the country has recently soured on immigration, which has been blamed for reducing housing affordability. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. When American voters head to the polls on November 5th, they'll be choosing not only a president, but also who controls the U.S. Congress. Whatever political party ends up controlling the House of Representatives or the Senate will be key to the success or failure of the new president's legislative agenda. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson looks at key races around the country.
Talk to voters and make sure they're voting all the way down the ballot.
Donna West, a longtime Democratic activist, does not just organize voters for Vice President Kamala Harris from her Las Vegas, Nevada garage. She says she is also fighting to make sure Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen keeps her U.S. Senate seat.
The more we can get out and talk to the voter, the more confident I am that we'll restore Jackie to the Senate and take that majority.
Nevada is one of just a handful of U.S. states nationwide with competitive Senate races that will determine if Democrats or Republicans hold the majority. Democrats currently hold a slim majority with 51 seats. Rosen's challenger, Sam Brown, who was injured while serving in Afghanistan, says it is time for change in Washington.
We've got an economy to go square away. Look, there's things we can do from the housing to our energy policy. We've got to go after this border situation.
In Texas, traditionally a stronghold for Republicans, polls show a close race between Democrat Colin Allred and Republican Senator Ted Cruz. In their debate last week, Allred challenged Cruz on the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol.
This election is his accountability. You cannot just be patriotic when your side wins.
Cruz pushed back on that argument.
You don't hear him talking about the Antifa and Black Lives Matter riots that burn cities across this country.
And in the rural state of Montana, Democratic Senator John Tester faces a challenge from Republican Tim Sheehy. At the Democratic National Convention earlier this year, a delegate said that many voters in the state may vote for former president and Republican candidate Donald Trump, but will keep a Democrat in the Senate. Mary Jo O'Rourke is a Montana voter.
Senator Tester has delivered for us in terms of the farm bill, and we are way too smart to let that go.
But at the Republican National Convention, delegates said Tester's liberal voting record is not right for the state. Susan Renault is a Montana voter.
Tim Sheehy is a real veteran. He is a combat hero. He is a Navy SEAL.
Control of the U.S. House of Representatives could also potentially flip, moving from Republican control to the Democrats. All 435 House seats are up for re-election this year. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
And in a related story, with voting already underway in the 2024 presidential race, a new Pew Research Center survey reveals that supporters of Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have sharply different expectations for how this year's election may unfold. Jocelyn Kiley is the Senior Associate Director for Research at the Pew Research Center.
So this is a study that's focused on how voters this year are thinking about the election process itself. So not issues and attitudes and things like that, not even the candidates, but how much confidence voters have in the election system. Will the elections be run and administered well? Do people have confidence that their votes will be counted as they were intended? And so here we find, you know, broadly that voters are confident, but there's a big gap between Harris voters and Trump voters. Harris voters are much more likely than Trump voters to say that they think the elections this November will be run and administered well.
And how big is that difference? Is it enough to really matter on election day, do you think?
So it's less about what'll matter in terms of showing up on election day, but how voters will feel about the election afterwards, right? Will they feel good about the vote count? And I do think that we see some very big gaps. So for instance, about almost 90% of Harris voters say they're confident that mail-in ballots across the U.S. will be counted as voters intend, but that compares to only 38% of Trump supporters. So, you know, that's a pretty statewide gap as we think about this being a close election and potential contestations about, you know, which ballots might count, about how ballots are counted, these kinds of divisions we've seen over the last couple of years, a couple of election years, and how supporters of the two candidates view the election process.
Now, something in your study that I thought was particularly troubling was the view of the Supreme Court.
Across the board, there's not a tremendous amount of confidence that the Supreme Court will be politically neutral in its decisions. Neither large shares of Trump supporters nor large shares of Harris supporters say this, but Trump supporters definitely are more likely to express confidence that the Supreme Court will be politically neutral. About a third of Trump supporters say this, compared to less than 10% of Harris supporters. You know, substantial shares of both groups say that they have some confidence, but really a majority of Harris supporters say that they're not too or not at all confident that those decisions would be politically neutral.
Now, statistics being what they are, you spoke to just over 5,100 adults in a nation of hundreds of millions of people. How significant is your study? How accurate do you think it'll be?
So in terms of the work that we do, you're right. Any poll can only interview so many people. But you know, we put a tremendous amount of energy and effort into sampling people randomly and then weighting our data so that it really is representative of the American public. And so on these attitudes represent not just a set of survey respondents that are not reflective of the country, but really are reflective of how Americans and Americans of all stripes view these issues.
Jocelyn Kiley is a Senior Associate Director of Research at the Pew Research Center. Ms. Kiley, thanks for your time today. Thanks for your analysis.
Thanks very much.
In rebel-held Syria, many people celebrated the deaths of Hezbollah leaders in Lebanon last month, even as they mourned the deaths of families in Gaza. As VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Istanbul, with Maa Atrash and Ahmad Falia in Idlib, Syria, the war in the Middle East is growing increasingly complex, with loyalties divided, even within individuals.
Celebrations broke out on the streets of Idlib, Syria last month after the death of Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah in Lebanon. They are chanting, "Hassan Nasrallah, go to hell." Nasrallah was killed by Israel, which is widely considered an enemy here in Syria. But here in the last part of Syria held by rebel forces, Hezbollah, an ally of the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, is also considered an enemy. Idlib is home to millions of displaced people from the Syrian war, which has killed more than 350,000 civilians since 2011. And bombs still rain down in the area, even as much of the world has forgotten about the war. The most notable supporters of government forces are Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, often referred to as the Shiite militias among families here. This is Hassan al-Hamid, a Syrian man who lives in a dilapidated tent in a crowded camp with almost no humanitarian aid.
We were forced to flee because of airstrikes and artillery bombing and the invasion of the regime and the Shiite militias on our villages.
In Gaza, the Ministry of Health says more than 43,000 civilians have been killed since Hamas attacked Israel in October 2023. Killing 1,200 people and kidnapping hundreds of others. Humanitarian workers in northwest Syria say the war between Hamas and Israel has raised complex feelings because of the widespread and passionate support for Palestinians in the conflict. Salma Saif is a humanitarian worker with a group called the Female Survivor Union, which helps female prison survivors.
We have very contradictory emotions. We are happy for the killing of villains who killed Syrian people and destroyed Syria. But it was Israel who killed them and also killed our brothers in Palestine.
By our brothers, she means fellow Arabs, Muslims, and civilian victims of international wars. Leaders of the rebel group holding most of Idlib say fighting continues with Hezbollah in Syria, even as Hezbollah forces fight Israel. Here's Omar Abdel Baki, an officer with Hayat Tahrir al-Sham.
We are enemies with Hezbollah, and this will never end. Since the last campaign on northwestern Syria, we have been working to expel the occupiers, including Hezbollah, Iran, and Russia.
And as the situation in Lebanon deteriorates, with 1.2 million people displaced and more than 1,500 dead, the humanitarian crisis in Syria also gets worse each year. Aid has dwindled to almost nothing, and personal resources are long gone. Again, here's Hussein Al-Hamid from the displaced persons camp.
The people here live in tents. In the summer, it feels like we are on fire, and in the winter, we feel like we are drowning.
Despite their suffering, he says, families here grieve for the lives and dreams lost in Gaza. If he could, he says, he would support them with his blood. With Muawiyah Atrash in Idlib, Syria, Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
Islamist militants in Burkina Faso have begun using territory in Ghana's north as a logistical hub. Some see it as a move that could help them expand their footprint in West Africa. Reuters' Sean Hogan has more.
Islamist militants fighting in Burkina Faso are on a campaign to expand their footprint in West Africa. And seven sources, including Ghanaian security officials and diplomats, have told Reuters the fighters are discreetly using Ghana's north as a logistical and medical rear base, stocking up on food, fuel, and even explosives, as well as getting injured fighters treated in hospital. Burkina Faso has lost control of over half its territory as a pro-Al-Qaeda group known as JNIM have gained ground. Klingendaal, the Netherlands Institute of International Relations, said in a recent report Ghana appeared to have accepted a de facto non-aggression pact with JNIM, citing high-ranking government sources. Experts say that risks letting militants put down roots in Ghana. Here's Kaz de Bruyne from the Institute.
And we did see a number of incidents where JNIM is or JNIM associates are likely present in Ghana for some time, temporarily passing by, making procurements, sometimes trying to do recruitment. And so that is really serving as a wake-up call.
Ghana holds elections on December 7th. It is seen as a strong democracy and has a close relationship with the West.
Ghana wants to really make sure that so that they can have their elections, that there are no attacks. They know, of course, of their risks that they have in Ghana and know what extremists are capable of, and they really want to prevent that. JNIM, at the same time, they're going to face then a really committed, really strong army, I'd say. And I mean, they don't want to attack their own supply line and their safe havens.
Ghana shares a nearly 400-mile border with Burkina Faso. The country is at the heart of an insurgency that has killed thousands and displaced millions. Experts say the Sahel region is now the epicenter of global terrorism as factions loyal to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State expand their presence. A JNIM leader this week told French broadcaster RFI it was aiming to push into Ghana, Togo and Benin. Unlike Benin and Togo, Ghana has not suffered a major attack. Ghana's ambassador to Burkina Faso told Reuters the militants were taking advantage of porous borders. He denied suggestions of a non-aggression pact with the jihadists and said Ghana was working with Burkina Faso to flush them out. Ghana's information ministry declined to comment. Since Islamist militants emerged in West Africa 20 years ago, multiple countries, including Burkina Faso, have tried similar informal non-aggression pacts. They all collapsed as the insurgencies gained strength or governments fell, with junta's expelling Western military support and turning to Russia for help instead. Western nations have since refocused resources on efforts to shore up northern regions, with Ghana at the heart of those plans.
That's Sean Hogan of Reuters reporting for us, and that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.